From WXXI News, I'm Michelle Faust, and this is Connections Healthy Friday. How safe is your medical data? After Anthem, Blue Cross, and now Primera have revealed major cyber attacks that affected millions of their members, we're talking part of this hour about cybersecurity and how large a role it plays, and maybe it should play, in the storage of your medical records. We'll also get later this hour some headlines of the major health stories over the past week. And stay with us to the end of the hour. We'll be talking about a new Ken Burns documentary series on WXXI-TV. The topic, cancer. The series, The Emperor of Maladies. That airs later this month, and you'll have a special chance to watch it and join us for a discussion at The Little this Monday evening at 6 o'clock. Ann Savastano from the Golisano Hope Lodge Hospitality House will join us at the end of the hour for that preview. Right now, we're going to be talking about healthcare. This week, reporter Michelle Andrews wrote for NPR and Kaiser Health News a story that affects our entire state. The headline says it all. Most New York marketplace plans lack any coverage for out-of-network care. Joining us over the phone is Michelle Andrews. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Thank you. So we heard this on, where we read it on NPR and Kaiser Health News that many of these marketplace plans do not have out-of-network coverage. Why did you figure out, how is it that you came across this story?
Well, this was my own personal experience, actually. I am self-employed, and I buy my health insurance coverage on the New York State Exchange because I'm based in New York City. And when I went to look at plans, I discovered that while there were dozens to choose from in New York City, none of them had out-of-network coverage. And I just thought that was really surprising and wondered how common it was.
And how common did it prove to be?
Not at all common. When I asked McKinsey & Company, a big human resources consultant that looks often at what kind of coverage is available on the exchanges nationwide, I asked them to take a look, and they came back to me and they said, well, you know, in only 1% of cases where people who are eligible to shop for coverage on the exchanges nationwide, is it the case where, so in 99% of the cases, people have more than HMOs to choose from, which is means we here in New York are special, but not really in a great way.
And so, yeah, the comparison to the rest of the country really is astonishing. What is that going to mean for people when they're getting their coverage?
Well, I think it depends. You know, if an HMO has a really good network, a broad network of providers, it may not mean anything because you can, you know, tap into the providers that you need. But on the exchanges, there's been, as you know, a lot of press about how a lot of these plans have very narrow networks, and that can be problematic if you're stuck only being able to go to in-network doctors and with no coverage at all for out-of-network care.
Now, one of the questions that comes to me right away, you may not have the answer off the top of your head, but, you know, how many people really realize when they're buying their coverage how small or how large their network is?
I've found that it's difficult to find the answer to that. You know, it's not like you can look on the plan's description and see how many doctors, and maybe that doesn't matter, the number per se. There are requirements in the health law that networks be adequate, and so then it becomes a question of what is the definition of adequate. And depending on your health, you know, that answer may be different, because if you're a really healthy person who doesn't need a lot of care, then you may do just fine with a very small network. But, you know, for a lot of people who have chronic conditions or serious conditions, you know, they need specialists, and those specialists may not be in network if you have a narrow network HMO.
You know, in my coverage of the Affordable Care Act, a lot of the conversations that I've had with people is when they're signing up for health care, they're asking themselves exactly that. Is this specialist that I believe I need or from that surgery that I had going to be available to me?
Yeah, I think that that's probably the best way to check out the plans that you're considering because, you know, is by looking at particular doctors. I think you can have confidence, you know, that there are going to be a certain number of endocrinologists in the network, for example. But you know, if you have particular doctors you really need to see, then it really matters that they be in network.
Michelle Andrews, thank you so much. We rely on your coverage for national issues from the Affordable Care Act, and we hope our listeners stay tuned with WXXI for all of our coverage in our Understanding the Affordable Care Act series. You can find that online at WXXI.org/ACA. Thanks for joining us, Michelle.
Thanks so much.
So, in the studio right now, we have many people here to talk to us about a lot of the different headlines that have affected health in the last week. But I'm going to start with Jeff Welcher. You're an account manager at Bond Financial Network. We've had you on the show before, and you've answered some of our questions. Thanks for joining us again.
Yes, thanks so much for having me back, Michelle.
I want your initial reaction to this conversation and this headline about the out-of-network and these narrow networks that people are dealing with for their
absolutely.
Healthcare.
I pride myself in self-study, but I will fully admit that I was not in the know on what Michelle is reporting, and that New York is unique, and that individual marketplace plans on the New York State of Health typically, well, it sounds like in all cases, are either HMO or EPO-style networks. Network strength is always a challenging topic. There is no perfect network. Even plans that have out-of-network coverage, there are still hoops to jump through. There is still something called balance billing, where an out-of-network provider might bill you above and beyond what your insurance is willing to pick up. It is definitely an interesting topic. New York is somewhat unique in that we're in the minority, and that New York did set up the state-based exchange as the federal government originally intended. So keeping track of what's going on in New York is paramount for me and my job. Keeping track of other exchanges and the federal stuff is interesting. And it's interesting that Michelle points out the differences even in her plan and what she's finding. New York City is a very unique, I mean, the largest market in the United States. New York City and where we are in Western New York are very different conversations. A lot of the network strength, the frustrations I hear from clients has to do with going to the Cleveland Clinic, and a little bit east, a little bit west. She makes a very good point about those with chronic conditions really need to do additional research. The last time I was here, it's all about research. If you're seeing a specific specialist or series of specialists, additional research is definitely needed, because as of right now, as Michelle Andrews pointed out, in New York, you're looking at these very defined networks, and we're lucky in Rochester that our defined network is quite strong, but that's not the case statewide.
Now, when we're talking about these narrow networks, it sounds like it's mostly an issue, and I'm going to have you answer that question, but it looks like it's mostly an issue for these on-the-marketplace plans. You deal with people who are going on-marketplace sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're going to go off the exchange to buy their insurance, and then a lot of people get, you know, the majority of people still get their insurance through their employers.
Yes.
So is this an issue for other plans?
It isn't today. I believe the main reason the insurance carriers have put narrower networks into the exchange, some of it is fear of the unknown. And there is a lot of pressure to keep the cost down, even if it's only a 3% or 5% difference in price, which is, in my estimation, about what it is when you go to a narrower network that still has adequate coverage but not perfect. That cost savings of 3% to 5% is significant when you're talking about family plans that are well over $1,000 a month.
Now, we're not talking just about the ACA this hour, but I did want to ask you, because in the last hour we were speaking a lot about oral hygiene, oral health. How are people getting that paid for? Now, we talked about some offers through the Eastman Dental, mm-hmm. but people who have insurance, do enough people have dental insurance, and how do they get it?
Dental insurance, also a challenge, always and always has been. True dental insurance does not exist. The dental insurance that people think of, these are defined benefit. These are discount programs. Even the richest dental benefits are going to have a cap on coverage. Unlike medical insurance, where there is no cap nationwide, dental coverage, the cap is typically $1,000 to $2,000. My best advice for people on oral health is be proactive. You want to get the preventive care, children, adults, seniors, the full gamut. Self-insuring, whether that be in a health savings account, if you have the ability to fund one with pre-tax money, is typically the best advice I give to people when it comes to handling dental care needs. The health savings account component can work in conjunction with dental coverage through an employer or through the New York State of Health. Generally speaking, though, true dental insurance the way people want it to operate, unfortunately, does not exist. It would be cost prohibitive if it did.
Yeah, I've spoken to some people, and I wonder what your opinion is on this, that say, you know, pay for it out of pocket and using a savings account. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that's a good idea for a majority of people? It's not going to be for everyone, I'm sure.
Yes. It's better than the alternative, which is going without the treatments. The link between oral health and physical health is very, very well defined. There's no perfect solution to someone that needs $1,000 or $5,000 worth of dental care. Piecing together personal savings, health savings account savings, hopefully dental insurance, that all helps. But ultimately, it's a cost of living expense. There's no perfect solution. If there was, everyone would be doing it. It's tough. The insurance companies are taking money in and they're paying money out.
Now, one of the big headlines from this week was a settlement between the Attorney General and Excellus. And there's a situation that actually is a situation that has existed in many places around the country, but this particular settlement dealt with Excellus, and they said that they were planning to end a wrongful denial of mental health and addiction treatment services. Now, there's a lot of push, especially on the addiction treatment services, some of the reporting that we've done surrounding people who are trying to get longer time to be able to get treatment for heroin addiction, for example, mm-hmm. one of the things that we've done a lot on this program. How big of a problem is this in people getting their mental health parity, their mental health taken care of by their insurance?
I see this from time to time, and when I do, it is a disaster. Typically, the stories I hear from clients, it's usually a parent that is reaching out to me in they're desperate for assistance because either the insurance carrier or a facility is denying service to their dependent, their son, their daughter. The cost containment perspective is where the insurance carriers are coming from when they do want you to try outpatient treatment before inpatient. Unfortunately, substance abuse, it snowballs very quickly. There's very often not an opportunity to try outpatient when the patient is so sick, so down the wrong road. The insurance carriers, from a cost containment perspective, always want you to try something more affordable before you jump right into that surgery or that MRI machine or whatever the case may be. Mental health gets very, very tricky because you cannot, morally, it's very tough to deny someone inpatient treatment when it is so clear that is what they need. The insurance carriers, they have a very fine line. It is a tightrope they are walking between inpatient, outpatient. Do you deny services? Do you force certain treatments before other treatments are approved? This comes up a fair amount.
Okay. And just one last specific ACA-related headline question. This was a study that came out from Kaiser Family Foundation, and they were tracking people's opinion of the Affordable Care Act. Now, you know, this is speculative. You know, what are you thinking that people are thinking about the Affordable Care Act? But they're showing that the opinions are narrowing, that more people are kind of more accepting and just realizing that this is the way it is and aren't so strongly in favor or against. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you see that that way. It says this month, 41% of American people favor the law, 43% oppose it, and so many people just are not worrying about it quite as much.
I think many have reached a point of exhaustion. It's mental exhaustion. There's parts of the ACA that are working, there's parts that are not working, and that's fairly typical for any governmental program. Where it's working right now, it's doing quite well. There's certainly a lot of room for improvement. I think ultimately the conversation of the country is beginning to move on, and that's probably good. I think the ACA will do better the less people are poking and prodding it.
The most interesting stat from this study from Kaiser Family Foundation was saying that most people, 57% of people say they're not affected by the ACA.
Yes, and I would agree with that. New York has seen some tremendous enrollments through the state exchange, but a lot of that has been due to the expansion of Medicaid.
A lot of it's Medicaid expansion, but a lot of people are, like we said before, most people are getting their insurance through their employer, so not a whole lot changing really for them.
Correct. The employer-based method of obtaining health insurance remains the path for most, and a lot of that has to do with the tax advantages of going that route, both for the employer and the employee, their ability to pay those premiums with pre-tax dollars and to take advantage of their employer's contribution, which in turn saves the employer tax monies as well.
Thank you very much. Jeff Welcher will be staying with us for more of the hour, but I want to introduce and welcome some more of our guests. Ed Holden is Assistant Professor of Information Technology at RIT. Welcome.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
And Andy Manili, is the Assistant Professor of Software Engineering at RIT. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And thank you so much for coming and talking to me. Unfortunately, we've had lots of reasons to speak recently because, as we said at the beginning of the hour, big cyber attacks, big breaches in people's health information. So just this week, it was announced that 11 million customers, these are customers who were former or current and people who maybe just happened to be slightly associated with Primera Blue Cross in Washington State, also does business in Alaska, had their information taken, basically. And that comes after a few months ago, Anthem Inc., which is based in Indiana, had a huge attack that affected 78.8 million people. So just lots and lots of data being taken. Now, I've spoken to you before, and you had a slight difference of opinion. Andy, you said it's a big deal to have your health data compromised.
Absolutely.
Okay, so talk to me about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to have demographic data to be stolen about you. Identity theft is a problem, but if somebody steals clinical data about you, that bell can't be unrung. That is irreversible damage. And so these attacks are really terrible. I mean, it's one thing to have someone be able to impersonate you, to be able to take your social security number, but social security numbers can be changed, money can be repaid, but information about you, you can't put that back in the box.
Yeah, as far as the health information, and you know, people talk about that in terms of HIV status and many other things. Now, not completely, Professor Holden, not completely different opinion, but you did have a slight difference of opinion about how important it is, your medical data as opposed to your other personal identifiers.
Yes, I tend to look at it more broadly, and although I agree with what Andy just said, there's no question about that. You know, with medical data, you're dealing mostly with things that are very intimate to you, things you don't want other people to know. And that bell, as he said, cannot be unrung. But I'm also concerned really when any data is lost. So if we take a look at the Primera situation, in addition to that, they have names, Social Security, they've got address, they've got birth date, things like that. I mean, that's all the information you need to open a new credit card. So lots and lots of damage can be done with that. Granted, that can be changed as soon as people actually take action to do something about it. And that's really one of the problems. One of the problems that people are very kind of laissez-faire about what information they give out to providers and how they, you know, how they keep track of that information that they've given out. Like how often do you change passwords? You know, I've talked to people that have never changed passwords. You know, some people that use passwords, the same password on every site. So there's lots of things that, you know, when that data is stolen can do a lot of damage. And if they get a hold of that information, you never know where they can really go with that information. There's, you know, other sites that they could attack using the same IDs and passwords and things like that.
Now, I want to get more to focus on the importance of our health data and these particular attacks. But, you know, I have so many web accounts at work, personally, you know, I teach on the side. I can only keep track in my brain of so many passwords. I do have more than one, but I mean, what recommendation would you give somebody?
Well, there are lots of ways to deal with that. If we just look at passwords in general, passwords are, you can vary the password for every site that you have. So if you have, say, 10 sites, maybe you use a root password, and then you have some things that you add on to the end of it that you can remember that are unique to each site, you know, that will help to have you have a different password for each site. Another way that a lot of people are catching on to now are using password organizers. You know, there are a lot of them available now that, you know, you can, KeePass is one of them, for example, that really will generate a very secure password for you and keep it secured, you know, on your machine so that you really just copy and paste it into the website. And so, for example, you could have a totally different, random, wild-looking password for every site that you sign on to. So that's one way to do it. I know that sounds complicated, but we have to, I think, sometimes take, you know, some additional responsibilities when we're dealing with our data off-site. There's other things that people can do. You know, being careful about providing information when it's requested. I mean, people will often, you know, you get an email and somebody will be asking you for a password or for some other personal information. Never respond to those things, ever. Those are the type of thing that can be very, very dangerous. You know, and other things, you know, checking your credit card statement each month. Is there anything on there that you don't recognize? A lot of people never look at the individual line items. Just look at the line item and say, do I remember doing this? Or in a case of like my wife and I, you know, I'll ask, did you do this or did you do that? Just to make sure that you can account for everything that's on there. Normally the amounts will be right, but you want to make sure that you don't see charges that you don't recognize. Checking your credit report once a year. That's something that you can do freely through the credit reporting agencies. You know, and a lot of people never request their credit report, but by law, they have to give you a free credit report every year. And so you can request that. So there's also, wherever it's possible, take advantage of what's called two-factor authentication. So for example, I enter for my bank, I enter my user ID and my password, and then I press a button and they email me a third piece of authentication that's only good once. And so I go to my email account and just copy and paste that into my, you know, into the screen. And so it makes it almost really impossible for somebody who's not me, you know, to go in and be able to do things in my account. But there's lots of things like that that people can do and take responsibility, you know, for their own data.
Now, I'm going to go back to the situation with first with Anthem, which was a huge 78.8 million people with their information compromised. And then Primera this week with 11 million. They've only got, you know, it was just under 2 million customers of their own. So this is a huge number of people who are not even their current customers at, mm-hmm. at this time. There's some speculation that there's a connection because they are both Blue Cross Blue Shield under the brand of Blue Cross Blue Shield. But Primera and Anthem, as they've said very many times, and our local Blue Cross providers, they are all individual companies. Is this just mere coincidence that it's two Blue Cross companies, or is this a possible link? There's speculation that they're related. And the companies are saying that's not the case.
Well, certainly the companies are going to be looking into this. I mean, my understanding is that companies like Mandiant and the FBI, well, the FBI is looking into this as well. And I understand that there's some forensic analysis being done on the malware that was being used. I understand that we have not seen the data appear online in the black markets over the last couple of months, which is a very interesting fact. There is some speculation that it's possibly a state-sponsored espionage activity that is on the table. That's certainly a possibility. About the passwords and all that stuff, you know, that stuff is important for digital citizenship for the average person, but to me, the responsibility is actually on these companies. We need to be engineering secure software. We need to be delivering secure software. We need to be securing not just the outer parts of our company, but the inner parts as well. We need to be thinking about defense in depth. We need to be thinking about insider threat. These are things that companies need to think about. Security is really easy to ignore. It's the easiest thing to ignore because it's one thing to get your system to work. It's another thing to make sure that it can't be broken.
So security is a big issue. I've spoken to our local Blue Cross provider, Excellus, and they provided a statement saying that they are watching the situation, that they have not seen any breaches here locally. They're saying, and the other insurers are also saying, that the people who are here locally that could be at risk maybe went to Washington State, maybe went to Indiana and saw a doctor while they were there, saw a doctor, you know, when they were using these other services under the Blue Cross, the Blue Cross branding. Could also be somebody who lived in those former places and were a former customer of the other organizations and then have moved here. I mean, they're saying that there's not a link, and you know, that remains to be seen. Are these companies doing enough, Jeff?
There, again, it comes back to cost. There's a lot of pressure to keep the cost down, keep things as lean and mean as possible. In a best-case scenario, every insurance company that's operating in the United States right now is operating on around 15 cents on the dollar. And that is the most they can possibly be running at, where for every dollar that comes in, 85 cents is being paid out in claims. And that leaves, unfortunately, as my colleagues in the room mentioned, it leads to a point where a lot of corners sometimes get cut. Sometimes corners get skipped entirely. That's not to say that these companies aren't working very hard on security, but they have many, many things going on. There's many pressures, and unfortunately, there's only so much money and so much personnel to go around. I'm hopeful that these two will be the only two in terms of data breaches. You know, and it's very tough to say on whether these Blue Cross Blue Shield licensees are using similar architecture at the ground floor to build their brands. I can say from my experience, Blue Cross Blue Shield in Buffalo and Rochester, very, very different.
Very, very different corporations in the way they're run and
managed. Correct, and that's in the same state, 70 miles away from each other.
Okay. Well, and then that's just something that remains to be seen. Funny thing, I mentioned it to you, Professor Holden, but I'm going to ask the question to you, Professor Manili, about this whole situation with Primera. When I was working on the story this week, I was reading the story from the Wall Street Journal. Funny, the first comment from one of the readers, another day, another breach. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's been happening. You know, we're maturing in the computing field. We are maturing, and we have integrated computers into our everyday lives, and now we're finding out what happens. And you know, this is all part of the growing pains that we're going through right now. I have a feeling we'll be seeing more of these. I'm not trying to scare everyone, but we are going to be seeing those. Now, that being said, when you look at the research being done, at the number of security consulting firms that are going out there and securing other companies, security is a huge part of the conversation. And so I do see a lot of improvement. Every day I study vulnerabilities and how attackers actually break into systems. And a lot of times these are very fixable problems. There are problems that are hard to find and they lead to catastrophic circumstances, but they are fixable problems. But yes, in terms of the short term, I have a feeling we will be seeing some more of these.
The central question this hour is, how secure is your medical data? We'll be talking about that for the rest of the hour. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to member-supported public radio on WXXI. This is Connections. Healthy Friday.
I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the next Connections. First hour, we sit down with Julie Philip. She's with the Democrat and Chronicle, and we're talking about the future of the editorial page. Does it still have an impact the way it used to? What's the future of the newspaper industry? Then second hour, we sit down with a panel including District Attorney Sandra Dorley, talking about the future of the grand jury system. Does it need to be reformed? Talk to you Monday.
Reporter Ethel Payne's pointed questions won her attention and access as one of the first black journalists to get a White House press pass.
I was not there for decoration. I was there to get the information, dispense it, and to ask probing questions.
Her story later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that'll be this afternoon at 4 on this, your NPR news station.
You're listening to Connections Healthy Friday. I'm Michelle Faust. Thanks for joining us. Right now, we're speaking with Professor Ed Holden from RIT. He's a professor of information technology. And Professor Andy Manili, a professor of software engineering at RIT, both associate professors with the institution. And we're going to be talking a lot more about these breaches in both Primera and Anthem, both Blue Cross corporations, separate corporations, but they both have had recent, very large cybersecurity breaches, and we'll be talking about that. If you have a question about that and the security of your health information, give us a call, 1-844-295-TALK, 1-844-295-8255. And in just a few minutes, we'll be changing the subjects just very slightly to be talking about cancer and a series coming up on WXXI television, Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies. So Guys, how safe is my health information? Let's just start with that very brief, very overarching question.
Well, I think generally our health information is safe. The problem I think that we run into is we have so many different moving parts in this thing. So, you know, you've got electronic health records in your doctor's office. You know, you've got electronic records in the insurance companies, which is what we're talking about in the first part of this. We've got the Rochester RIO, for example, where your data can flow between, you know, different agencies and so on to be available. Bridges between the hospitals so that data can go back and forth. So there's a number of different ways, you know, that these things can be penetrated. Security, you know, is probably the paramount issue. In addition, because otherwise it's just data storage, which we've been doing for years and years and years. But security, because this data is so sensitive, I think is a big deal. But I do think that generally your data is pretty safe. You know, there are, you know, we have big things. It's kind of like the car accident versus the plane accident thing. You're much safer flying in a plane, okay, but the plane is the one that makes the big news stories. And this is what happens with Primera and Anthem, for example. We got millions of people whose data has been exposed. However, I think your data would be much more secure in an electronic health record than it would be in a paper file. And I think this is one of the issues we run into. You know, one example is a couple of years ago, my doctor's office burned down. And because they had an electronic health record, no data was lost. And I think, you know, in the old days, all of my patient records would have been lost. And so we have to balance this, you know, the bad news we get with really what some of the good news is. So I think generally it's good, but that doesn't mean we can let our guard down. And, you know, as Andy mentioned, you know, I think the companies, the doctor's offices, the providers, the insurance companies, the RIOs, all of these have a big obligation to really protect our data. And that's what, if you can ask any questions, those are the questions that you want to ask your providers. How are you protecting my data?
Now, it's interesting because we're talking about the protection. We've looked already. You mentioned that there's these third-party websites that will, a black market site that will take your data and then try to sell it. So mm-hmm. there's a stolen credit card number can be purchased, or a stolen Social Security number can be purchased on one of these sites. Now, this data has not shown up on any of these sites, and there's some speculation that this could be not just a thief who's taken this data, but maybe it was espionage from another country. What would, say, everyone points the finger at China when these things kind of come up and they talk about cyber espionage. What does the Republic of China get from getting my health data, my Social Security number, my credit card?
So what a country like that would look for, and it's not just China. There are other, I mean, so North Korea, for example, has been investing a lot in cyber attacks. Mm-hmm. What they're really looking for is actually, out of the 11 million, they're really looking for a very small proportion of people that they can leverage for extortion, blackmail, things like that. Things that a state would be looking for. Typically, if it's hackers who are going after money, then that's where you get identity theft. Which, by the way, you can use clinical data for identity theft. There are ways that you can use that information to better forge identity records, and so that is a concern. But if it's state sponsored, then it's going to be whatever the state is looking for, and it's certainly something that we're seeing is happening a lot today, and so we don't really know. Unfortunately, from where we're standing, there's not a whole lot that we know about what happens, and there are a lot of details. If it is, that we probably may never know, or at least not for a long time. But it is important to remember that whenever you have data like this. There are going to be lots of different parties who are going to want to use it for many different purposes. And when we start thinking that way, when that mentality starts coming into not just patients, I think we're probably the first ones who are alerted by this because we're the ones affected by it. But when company executives start thinking this way, when engineers start thinking this way, when system administrators start thinking this way, then we start closing all of these doors. And to me, that's the best way forward. I'm not a person who likes to blame patients for when their data is stolen. It's really not on them. It really is on the people who have the data in the first place.
Now, really, you're saying we can't necessarily control it once we give that information to somebody else. Where is that balancing act? Because it seems like there's a good piece of this communication between the different doctor's offices, between your insurer and everyone. I mean, that communication portion makes the facility of somebody getting their whatever services that they need a lot easier, but it facilitates that whole process. But then at the same time, that opens the door for more possible cyber attacks, people losing information. What can we do? Where do we put that balance?
Go ahead. Well, that's what we call a trade-off, right? Okay. I mean, there's always a trade-off between functionality and usability. There's always a trade-off between features and security. And so the more that we need out of our systems, the more ways they are going to allow us to break in. And so, earlier you asked the question, how secure is our data? And that is an important question. It's not easily answered. I mean, it's security is defined in the negative, and so we only know if it's insecure once we broke it. Mm-hmm. But the real question that we need to be asking ourselves is what do we need to do with this digitized data, and what benefit does it give us, and are there situations where, yes, there is a big benefit, but there is also a big risk, and that's really to me the questions that we need to be asking. Not just what can we do with this, but what are the risks when we start doing it.
Ed Holden, one of the things that that's come up in this conversation during this hour has been the question of investment. Are we investing enough in security? Should these different insurers, should the people who are in charge of our medical records, be putting a larger portion of the monies that they're getting towards protecting our data?
Yes, I don't think that we are in terms of medical data. Financial companies, for example, spend a lot more on security than we, as a percentage-wise, than we would find in the healthcare field. And primarily, as Jeff mentioned there, that we have this squeeze on the profits of these companies or the amount that they can use for overhead. And something like this is just considered overhead. So we probably should be to give you kind of an example. With the Primera example, we have 11 million people who've been compromised. Primera is going to have to provide. First of all, they're going to have to hire a company to look at their security and analyze the problem and fix the problem and all of this stuff. And then for each of those 11 million people, they're going to be providing Credit Watch. They're using a company called All Clear is the name of the company, which is one of the big Credit Watch companies. And that's expensive. I mean, there's a charge for, providing that Credit Watch service. So if they had taken the money that they're going to be spending on this breach and spent it on security, we probably would have ended up with not having a breach, or maybe would not. But it's also the situation where in security, you got to be right 100% of the time. In, the hacker only has to be right once. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing that you hear, whether it's terrorist attacks or whatever it is. It's really a tough, tough battle. And I think that's, one of the areas that, we have to kind of step up to. We've got to figure out how to protect our data better. And I don't like to put the onus on people as well. I do agree with Andy very much that companies have to provide a way of protecting data. But there are things that you can do. I mean, for example, my doctor, has a little space to fill out on the form, what's my Social Security number? Okay, well, the Social Security number may not be necessary for anything. So the question is, how are you going to use this?
But if we're talking about some sort of something that you fill out online for the doctor. Sometimes you have to fill out a form to be able to access your own data online. They make it, if you don't fill in that form, that piece of the form, they won't let you move forward.
That's right. You should question. And see, this gets into the trade-off. Is it valuable enough for you that you're going to give away that piece of information? And everything in life is a trade-off. And, as Andy mentioned, this is one of them. I mean, we could make these systems so secure that nobody could get into them. And then, you know, it defeats the entire purpose of having the system. So there's, you know, there's a risk to whatever we do, you know, in life in general. And I think this is one of the areas where it's manifested, is, you know, this trade-off of how much security do you really want?
Well, we could have a whole hour on this one. I'm just going to ask the very brief question. You know, is this the end of privacy? Should we just give up on it and just say the internet world and the computer world, we're just... Everything is open.
No. Don't give up on privacy. that would be a mistake. I think we do need to understand the risks, and we do need to understand the consequences of what can happen, which is new. I mean, we've never heard numbers like this. 11 million, 78 million. These are huge numbers that only make sense in the massive world of the internet. But I'm looking at problems like this, and yes, there is almost always a way to break into a system. However, most of the ways the systems are broken into, it is usually a very silly mistake. It's usually something that's very fixable. And so I actually have to say that when I started studying security, I was actually more encouraged because I looked at these problems and I said, these are fixable engineering problems.
And that because we have finally a positive note, I think we're going to leave the conversation there. Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Ed Holden, Assistant Professor of Information Technology at RIT. Andy Manili is Assistant Professor of Software Engineering, also at RIT. And Jeff Welcher, Account Manager at Bond Financial Network. Thank you very much for being here. Now I'm going to joining us in the studio, we have another guest. Ann Savastano is the director of Golisano Hope Lodge Hospitality House at American Cancer Society. And you're joining us because we're talking this hour about all of the headlines and the news of things that have recently happened with health. And that's, you know, I'm a health reporter, so we're talking about health all the time. Now, the new headline that we want people to be paying attention to is a new series by Ken Burns. It will be on WXXI TV later this month. And that is called Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies. And you can join us for a showing of the first piece of this series of documentaries at the Little on Monday, March 23rd at 7 p.m. We hope you'll join us, and we'll be screening the program. You'll be able to watch that, and also I'll be there moderating a panel, and one of the people joining me on the panel will be Ann. Ann Savastano, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I want you to give us a bit of an overview of what you do with the American Cancer Society and what services people have available.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. As you said, I'm the director of the B. Thomas Golisano Hope Lodge Hospitality House. And Hope Lodges are a program and a service offered by the American Cancer Society. And there are 32 of them in the country. We provide free lodging to cancer patients who need to come to a large kind of metropolitan urban area for treatment to get the life-saving treatment they need, but live more than 40 miles away or an hour away. They're able to stay with us free while they complete their treatment and go through the entire process. And some people come and stay with us for, you know, a few days, and some people are with us for a few months and may come back again over the, you know, as long as they're in a form of active treatment, they're able to stay at the Hope Lodge. It's a wonderful, wonderful program that the American Cancer Society offers because it truly gives people access to the care that provides them the life-saving treatment. Many of these folks would probably say, no, I can't come to Rochester because I won't be able to afford a hotel. So it's all funded through donations to the American Cancer Society. The American Cancer Society also helps patients with programs like, we have a 24/7 1-800 cancer hotline, and it's an amazing tool for folks to have, an amazing resource that you can call at any point in time and ask about whether it's an event that we're having, your treatment protocol, medications that you've been prescribed. Of course, we always tell people talk to your doctor first, but at 2 a.m. when you're kind of stymied by some of this, you can call the 800 number and be able to chat with very highly trained cancer information specialists. It's a great resource. And we have a website, www.cancer.org. Again, very similar information that you can get on the from the telephone, but so many folks prefer to access electronically.
So
Talking about the Hope Lodge, it's something that I find very interesting because I do know people who have, because of whatever malady that they had, that they needed to have their cancer treated, that they had to travel or needed to stay closer to the hospital. Is this a service that is mostly for people who are living in rural areas, or are these people who are coming for specialty services that are available here in Rochester that may not be in their cities?
Both. So we do have a lot of folks that come from, we have pockets where folks tend to gravitate to Rochester from, the southern tier. A lot of folks come from the southern tier, the north country. But then there are also folks that come from all over New York State, as well as all over the country, because of a very specific clinical trial or a treatment protocol that's being offered here. So this is the best choice for them for their cancer at that period of time.
Now, it's interesting. I know that the American Cancer Society has a lot of information about cancer. If the portion of the preview that I was able to look at of the film that we will be airing on Monday at 7 o'clock, if people want to join us there at the Little, it had a video montage, and it was, for me, very emotive. It made me, I was very emotional to watch it. And it was, I can't remember what president went back to, but it had every president talking.
Well, I think Lyndon Johnson was the first one that I saw.
The first one in that video montage. Mm-hmm. And it was started with the LBJ and just kept going on and on, and the next president and the next president. And they were all saying the same thing. Within our time, we'll see the end of cancer. Within our time, we'll see the end of cancer. Within our time, we'll see the end of cancer. We haven't.
No. And I think, you know, especially because I also watched the same montage that you're talking about, we've learned over time much more than LBJ knew, that this is not one disease. This is many, many diseases. And even if you look at a disease like breast cancer, again, not just one disease, many different kinds of breast cancer. So the research has done its job. It's given us more information, and treatments are better, much more tailored for an individual, but it makes it a little bit more challenging to have a cure, because the reality is it's not a cure. It will be many, you know, many cures.
It's true. And we'll be talking about a lot of that. But there have been a lot of advancements. I think of the HPV vaccine that now exists that can, you know, you get it very young and it can prevent a major cause of cervical cancer, throat cancer, penile cancers, just by getting rid of and preventing an infection, a viral infection.
Right. And the gentleman that actually, three researchers who actually were kind of at the beginning of that research, were funded by the American Cancer Society and were local here at the University of Rochester Medical Center. So donor dollars at work, and it really is in our own backyard. But yeah, there are great advancements in Gleevec for children with leukemia, which was was a death sentence, is now very highly curable. So the wins are many. It just takes the dollars. And I think that would be my hope. One of the things that results of the show and getting the word out is that people will be more inclined to understand what comes with the dollars. That as the story said, the dollars for cancer research continued to go down, and it really needs to go significantly in the other direction.
Yeah. Now, I understand that you began in your work partially because of your own bout with cancer.
Yeah, I was diagnosed with breast cancer 34 years ago. I was 25 at the time, and a different age. I mean, sort of like those LBJ years. There weren't pink ribbons. There weren't walks. It was a very different time and a different day to be diagnosed. And I had felt a need to give back in some way. I felt lucky that I was doing well, and I started to volunteer with the American Cancer Society, had a lovely career that I enjoyed in a totally different field, but changed careers midstream and wanted to be a part of this wonderful organization that was really trying to not only make it better for patients, but also investing dollars to find a cure or cures. We're helping people to adapt screening guidelines so that they, if they were going to be diagnosed, would be diagnosed early when it would be treatable. And the fact that there were also fun things to do with the American Cancer Society, which is, you know, fundraising and events, but it was just a great an organization to me that just represented so many good things.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you mentioned the pink ribbon. I mean, there's a lot of talk, especially because of a lot of just the conversation, pushing the conversation forward about breast cancer and women's battles with that. But there's been some criticism that I've read of people who say that there maybe is too much focus on one type of cancer instead of spreading the money out and spreading the emphasis and the research out to different types of cancer. Do you see that as necessarily an issue, or is it just we need to look at them all?
Well, I think part of that is perhaps understanding, or for people to understand, that research that may be done originally directed for breast cancer may ultimately unlock a key that is going to help with prostate cancer or ovarian cancer. So there's just because there's some funding for one particular cancer doesn't mean that ultimately it will exclusively only help people with that particular disease.
Now, most of our listeners are close enough to the Rochester area that they wouldn't necessarily need the services that you provide. But if someone did know someone that needed to come in mm-hmm. and use those services, how would they get a hold of you?
The best way to access any program or service or get information about the American Cancer Society is to call 1-800-227-2345. And there might be folks here in Rochester that are going to travel for their treatment. They may go to Cleveland, New York City. They can access a Hope Lodge in those communities. So good information.
So they can talk to you, talk to American Cancer Society,
absolutely.
And get more information.
Absolutely.
Now, we hope that many people will join us on Monday at the Little Theater. That'll be at 7 p.m. beginning the program Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies. That'll be a pre-screening of the docuseries that will be airing on WXXI-TV starting on Monday, March 30th at 9 p.m. Join us at the Little Monday at 7 p.m. Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies. It's a series of documentaries by Ken Burns. I'm Michelle Faust. You are listening to WXXI and Connections Healthy Friday. Thanks for joining us, and thank you very much, Anne Savistano, for joining us here.
Thank you.